This is the sound of PCJ. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone. It's very nice to have you with us once again on the program. Coming up today, we're putting the spotlight on Rhodesia. Today, the country, of course, is known as Zimbabwe. Our special guest is someone who worked in television and radio in the 1970s in Rhodesia, and he'll be giving us an insight of what it was really like. This is Media Network Plus, on the internet, on satellite, on shortwave, and anything else you can imagine. Even the bed. Our special guest on today's program is Mr. Derek Partridge. Derek is from the United Kingdom and spent a number of years in Rhodesia working in television and radio. He hosted his own nightly talk show called Frankly Partridge. After he left Rhodesia, he made appearances on American television, but his American television appearances go back even further. He made a guest appearance on the original Star Trek series in the 1960s. Today we're putting the spotlight on Rhodesia and what it was like working in the media in that country during its civil war. But this is what I want you to do first. Just picture yourself, you've just had dinner, you're sitting down, you turn on Rhodesian television, and this is what you see.
Good evening. We're starting off tonight on the martial arts. With me in the studio to tell us something about one specific aspect of them are Patricia Backer and Eric Morris. Good evening and welcome to you both.
Well, although it perhaps wasn't said, I, in essence, became a non-person because we in Rhodesia were subject to United Nations sanctions, and I, in effect, had broken that by going out there to work. No, it never in any way affected me by people saying that, but I know exactly what you're talking about from what happened to you, and that would have been the attitude from Prime Minister Harold Wilson, but it didn't seem to permeate down to many other people. In fact, I would say the majority of the people in England were very pro-Rhodesia. They were not on the side of Harold Wilson. Probably the majority of Rhodesians were of British origin. Rhodesians came from, you know, many countries around the world, but the majority certainly would have been of British origin.
When you ended up at the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation, you said the decision took 10 seconds to go down there. And, you know, they're saying, okay, come down here as a TV presenter. This was your something that you've been dreaming about for all this time. What was it like the first day that you showed up for work and said, okay, we have a TV show to do?
Well, first of all, it wasn't the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation. It was Rhodesian Television. At the time, Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation was the radio station, and it was state-controlled. RTV, Rhodesian Television, was a private company, very successful, and a completely independent entity from it. Later on, I'll tell you what happened with that. But at the time, no, it was an independent entity. Mike Hart Jones, for my first talk show, gave me two priests who were both very talkative and very controversial because they came from opposite sides of certain religious beliefs. So I didn't have to do one heck of a lot. Yeah, I suppose it was, but it seemed to come very naturally to me. I really didn't have any problems with it. I just got on with the job and did it. Because of the war, we did have a teleprompter, but we didn't have enough personnel to operate it. So for the news, you read scripts which you had previously typed or the news department had typed. And it was rather funny. We were rather formal there, sort of, you know, suit and tie, but because of the heat, we usually had sort of bathing trunks underneath where you couldn't see them. It actually reminds me of the early days of British radio broadcasting when Lord Reith was in charge. And this is for radio, I stress. He insisted that his radio newscasters were tuxedos, dinner jackets, with high pointed wing collars digging into their throats. hard to imagine anything more stupid. No, not really much of a problem. But frankly, Partridge was a live show, so things can go wrong, and you often find yourself sitting in your seat, and you can see the control room, and you can see people panicking madly, and you have to sort of sit there very calmly and try and get through it. And I remember once I was set to interview one of the Rhodesian Air Force squadron leaders, and he was late. Well, it's a live show, you have to go on. So I sat in my chair, and I swiveled around interviewing myself until he rushed into the studio and saved the situation.
Well, you know, when you were working for Rhodesian Television, you said it was a private company, and there were UN sanctions against Rhodesia. The equipment that they were using at Rhodesian Television was black and white. They didn't get color until the early 1980s. Where did the equipment come from? Was it surplus equipment from the UK?
The equipment, I'm sure, came from South Africa. I mean, most stuff came from South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, during sanctions, South Africa very kindly supplied us with many, many things. And, of course, benefited financially very strongly from it. You know, we had sanctioned busters all over the world clandestinely acquiring equipment that we needed for every aspect of life and living. But and there was a certain amount of rationing. There were certain shortages, but nothing that was really serious that didn't impinge on one's daily life. One thing about the news, though, you would read your newscasts, and then you would go and listen to the BBC to see what the news really was. You know, there was a certain amount of censorship, I suppose you can call it that, but when you're at war with a terror organization, it's not unreasonable that you have to have some control over what you broadcast to people. It's a very small country, very close-knit, and one of the worst jobs that we had to do every night when we started off the newscast, the first item was, Combined Operations Headquarters regrets to announce the death in action of, and then you would sometimes read your own friends' names. That was tough.
During the time when you were presenting Frankly Partridge and also the newscast, you said that RTV was a private organization, unlike the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation, but would, for example, the newsroom or yourself or the producers, say, get phone calls from the government saying, look, we heard that you have this story. We wish that you wouldn't go ahead with it.
No, I simply don't know the answer to that. I imagine that in the newsroom where most of the stories were written, there was some form of control, some form of checking to ensure that what went out was not something they didn't want to go out. But I was not personally aware of any direct censorship.
This is the Rhodesia Broadcasting Corporation Radio Jacaranda, broadcasting in the medium wave band and from 6 p.m. to close down, also on shortwave in the 120-meter band. The time is at 2 o'clock.
Here's the Saturday sound. It's Tony's Saturday Scene.
Here's Tony.
Well, hi there. Glad you could join me on this very hot and sunny afternoon for the next 2 hours of the new, the not so new, and those great golden oldies. And one of those coming up right now.
No milk today. Yeah, I was just about to say, I was listening to some air checks of the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation, and I think something that would surprise many people, because when I mentioned that I was doing this interview with you, people that say didn't know that Zimbabwe was once Rhodesia, and there are some people out there who didn't know that, they were thinking, oh, African broadcaster, it probably sounds like everything else out there today, and it didn't. I mean, RBC sounded very, very professional.
Oh, it was indeed. The people there tried their very best to emulate the BBC, even though they were the RBC.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the ambition of a number of them to someday get to Britain and work for the BBC.
You know, there were some people also, very well-known people that worked for the RBC. One of them is who was also a comedian by the name of Warwick Starr.
I knew both Rex Starr and Clem Soleil more by name. for whatever reason, I think that by the time I got there, they were either not working there anymore or working less. And I think I may have met them, but I don't have any particular memories of either of them. But they're both sort of legends for Rhodesians.
Now, you're from the UK, and you were working in Rhodesia, and the British government was very, very forceful in pushing sanctions toward Rhodesia. How did the local population see you? Did they see you as somebody, oh, you see, look, people do support us. People, you know, he's from the UK. Did they welcome you with open arms?
Very much so. I remember when I started off doing a weather forecast one night, I said something about your weather will be so-and-so. And Mike Hart Jones, after the broadcast, said, it's not your weather, it's our weather. I felt that they adopted me as a Rhodesian, which is exactly what I felt like, and I adopted Rhodesia as my adopted country. It's still one of the most wonderful memories. And I still even carry in my wallet my Rhodesian identity card. It was made of metal, because this was for the elections, and if the ID cards had been made of plastic, they could have been easily forged. But the metal process was too expensive and too difficult. So, yeah, that's still in my wallet. And I remember it used to go through the scans at the airports, and something would go off, and I'd go, oh, damn, it's my metal identity card.
When you were in Rhodesia and doing the TV series, how long did that run for, and what was your deciding factor on leaving?
Everything I did there, the news, the Frantic Partridge, the Quiz Kids, and I did many Message to the Nation specials. I was there for 2 years. Then what happened is that the Minister of Information, who was a great supporter of me, died, and at the same time, somebody in government decided that RBC, the radio, should take over RTV, so that it became, again, a totally government-controlled entity. As a result of that decision, virtually the entire staff of RTV resigned in protest. Some 25 people, all the top producers, directors, technicians, engineers, everybody resigned. They just weren't prepared to work for what we consider to be the idiots at RBC.
Mm-hmm.
This was an incredibly brave decision, because it wasn't like in any other country where you've got 10, 20, 30, 50 other TV stations you can go to. We had one television station in Rhodesia, so they were in fact cutting off their jobs and their professions, and they had nowhere else to go. I stayed on for a while because, unknown to the people at RBC, who had always been very jealous of at RTV, I had a contract, so they couldn't get rid of me initially. When the contract came to an end, they were only too happy to get rid of me. At that point, some people decided to get up a petition to keep me in RTV and in Rhodesia. And there were sort of booths set up all around the major cities with people collecting signatures to keep Partridge in Rhodesia. And ultimately, it was as if you compare populations, it was as if about 10 million Americans signed a petition saying we want to keep this guy. And this petition was presented to the head of RBC, a very unpleasant Irishman called Jimmy Neal. It didn't achieve anything, and so eventually I left. I did return to the country after that because this Rhodesia as it really is leaflet I did, I revised it and did a new version. So I came back to the country to do that.
What is it like if somebody was to say to you, Derek, what do you want people to remember about Rhodesia? Because Zimbabwe today is a very, very different place. I mean, inflation is just skyrocketed. I mean, if you want to buy a liter of milk, it costs nearly 10 million shillings.
Well, I have a banknote in my wallet. I have one for $50 billion and one for $100 trillion, which is worth $15 American. They have now gone off the Rhodesian dollar, and they're using the South African rand and the American dollar as their currency. Yes, it is a very different country. In the old days of Rhodesia, there were some ancient ruins in Rhodesia called the Ruins of Zimbabwe, which Eric von Daniken, in his book Chariot of the Gods, wrote about. Very mysterious, nobody knows their origins. But one of our tourist brochures was to say, come to Rhodesia and see the ruins of Zimbabwe. Now we say, come to Zimbabwe and see the ruins of Rhodesia. We used to be the breadbasket of Africa. We exported food to many African countries. We are now the basket case of Africa. Mugabe has completely and utterly destroyed the country and its people. The average age expectancy in Rhodesia now is something slightly in excess of 30 years. And Mugabe is now in his mid-80s. And all we can hope is that he dies very soon.
You know, it's really amazing because some people that I've spoken to, they say that people that were against Rhodesia, they've all said, oh, there was media censorship. Ian Smith had a network of spies and censorship and everything else. But people that I've spoken to who, like yourself, who were in Rhodesia at the time, including blacks who left to move to the United Kingdom and other parts of the world, said that wasn't the case. That's what it's like now.
Well, something that reminds me that I put into my leaflet. One of my black broadcasting friends at RBC said that blacks are far worse than whites. They are the worst oppressors and exploiters of blacks, far worse than whites. And that was a blunt, and I said, well, could I just say they could be? He says, Derek, you can modify it if you want. I'm just stating categorically that is the fact.
Have you been back since?
Only that time to, well, visit all my friends and to redo the leaflet Rhodesia as it really is. However, a situation came up quite a few years later by pure coincidence, when I'm living in Los Angeles. I was asked to go and audition for the lead in a film called Kariba. The lead was a police inspector who was investigating a bomb which had been placed on board an Air Rhodesia flight. And I went in to meet the people and said, actually, I have to tell you, you got it slightly wrong. It was not a bomb placed on board. It was the SAM-7 missile fired from the ground, a surface-to-air missile. And they said, well, what the hell do you know about it? I said, well, it just so happens I was the newscaster on duty that night when it happened and had to read the death of three of my friends. So that was quite an amazing coincidence. Unfortunately, their funding fell through, and so it never happened. And I thought that was the time I will be able to go back to my country.
After you left Rhodesia, after you left the second time when you went back to redo the leaflet, where did you go?
I think at that time I went to New York, and then somebody approached me, and I found myself in Florida, in Miami, on a radio station where I did two-hour talk shows every day and an hour of news in between. So it was a good solid five-hour stint.
What was it very different working in the U.S. than it was in Salisbury?
I was no stranger to the States, you see. I'm, in fact, half English, half American. My mother was American.
Oh, okay.
So I'd spent quite a bit of my life in the States up to that point, so I was not unfamiliar with it. It wasn't culture shock.
I think what I'm actually leading at is because the way you described, you know, RTV, it was sort of like, you know, this whole big family together, and we were trying to do the best we could under the conditions that we had, to going to a country that has everything.
Well, it was not the happiest of experience because a couple who had a television station, ironically, in Las Vegas, where I now live, had sold their TV station to Johnny Carson and then bought this radio station in Miami. The wife then hired the director of a travel agency to be the director of broadcasting. Well, she didn't exactly have much experience or credentials, so that was a major disaster. They then started firing people who'd been there for years and years, had a following, et cetera, just put up a notice on the board saying, you know, effective tonight at 6 p.m., so-and-so is no longer with the station. Well, at some point, I'd had enough of this nonsense, and I had become sort of like the star thing of the station because I was doing 5 hours a day. And so I just put up a notice on the board saying, effective 6 p.m. tonight, I'm no longer with the station. And that was the end of that one. I just thought it was a little bit of, you know, for the cruel way they treated the people who'd been there for years.
Let's talk actually about one thing. When I was looking at some of the TV programs that you were in, you were also in the original Star Trek TV series in an episode called Plato's Stepchildren. I have to ask this because there's somebody here who said, oh, you have to ask him about it. How did you get that gig and what was all that? What was that like?
Well, that was just, you know, my agent at the time submitted me for a role along with countless other people. They happened to pick me. And I found myself playing a 2,500-year-old gay Greek, which my wife at the time says was typical typecasting. Now, think about it. Any time you see a film made in Hollywood or a TV series made in Hollywood, if there's an Englishman in it, he's almost invariably gay. I don't know why, but the Americans just think of all Brits as being gay.
I think it's because of the handkerchiefs coming out of the sleeves or something.
This particular episode of Star Trek was somewhat historic, because we as ancient Greeks possessing telekinetic powers forced Kirk to kiss Uhuru and forced Spock to kiss Gene Roddenberry's wife. I've forgotten the character she played. So it was the first black-white kiss on television and the first intergalactic kiss on television. Now, the BBC, in all its wonderful prudity, refused to show the episode because of the black-white kiss, as did certain states in the southern part of America. How's that for racial prejudice?
Let's move on to your latest project, because there is a connection between you and British actor Leslie Howard, who died in a plane crash. You have a film coming out, and we don't want to give too much away, but what is this connection?
Okay, I was sitting in a plane on the runway in Lisbon Airport, Portugal, waiting to fly back to Britain. I was 7 years old. It was flight 777. At the last moment, Leslie Howard came along, and as a VIP, he and his manager took my place and my companion's place because we were the most unimportant people on a plane, which was done in priority of importance. The plane was then shot down by the Germans over the Bay of Biscay with the loss of all life. So basically, I owe my life to Leslie Howard. And a couple of years ago, I went over to London and hosted two films, one called Leslie Howard, The Man Who Gave a Damn, which is all about his life, and the other is The Mystery of Flight 777. There were many, many theories of conspiracies that Leslie Howard was, in fact, working for British intelligence. He just completed a tour for some cultural organization. There were other theories that the Germans had shot it down because certain other of the passengers were targets for them, people who were helping the Allied cause. In the course of my interviews, I interviewed the son of the navigator of the plane, who had spent a week with the pilot in charge of the German squadron, and it turned out that it was purely accidental. The German flight of Junkers had been on a routine coastal patrol when they came face to face, in a sense, going in opposite directions, with the Dakota. Before they identified it, they immediately started attacking on the basis of you attack before somebody attacks you. And when the colonel in charge of the flight eventually saw the civilian markings, he called off his planes, but by then it was too late. The plane had been hit mortally and plunged into the sea with the loss of all life. So there was no conspiracy. It was purely chance, purely an accident. And this account was given by this colonel shortly before he died. And as you said, I have nothing to hide. I have no reason not to tell you the truth. That is what happened. So that blew a lot of conspiracy theories out the window. And strange enough, by coincidence, at one point I had met Leslie Howard's son at a party, and he was just completing a book called In Search of My Father, and I was able to add some information as one of the last people to see him alive, which were then incorporated into the book. And the first film, Mr. Howard, The Man Who Gave a Damn, is having its press premiere in a few days' time in the cinema at Leslie's old home in Surrey.
Because that happened so many years ago, and when you heard that the plane had gone down and Leslie Howard and everybody else on board the plane had died, did you think of it differently then? Like, when you look back now, do you say to yourself, you know, I don't think I would have ever had the career that I've had. I don't think I would have ever been able to do everything that I had if I had not switched the seat with Howard and his manager. And compared, let's say, to back then when it happened.
I don't think so. I mean, it happened. I'm fortunate enough to be here, and that's about the only way I can look at it. It was just one of those quirks of fate. Quite often you hear stories of people who accidentally missed a plane which went down. Fate has some strange hands to play, and sometimes it plays into somebody's good fortune, and sometimes it's somebody's ill fortune. So yeah, I'm obviously very happy to be here, and I'm sorry it had to be at the expense of a very fine actor.
Derek Partridge, thank you very much for taking a little time, or rather a long time, to talk with us today. It's been a great pleasure to hear the stories of a country that so many people have so many misconceptions about.
That is so true. Keith, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And that was our special guest, Derek Partridge, on this week's edition of Media Network Plus. Well, normally at this time of the show, we say it's now time to look at propagation. But because we're kind of on a vacation right now, we're not going to be doing that until 2 weeks' time. So on behalf of Dan Hensley, who's also vacationing, and Paulette McQuarrie, who I believe is in Ukraine right now, this is Keith Perron wishing you well, hoping that you join us again very soon. 73s to you all, and 88s to the ladies.